All right, so today we're holding at the new parak, the eighth parak, Vayishlach. So until now, we've been talking about the inyanim of the ksuva. Remember, from the very beginning, surprisingly, this is something that the goyim miss out on completely, is that the ksuva creates the description of the interrelationship per se in terms of financials, which is really a very striking idea. In other words, the bottom line is that all of the various so-called romantic associations, which would have to do with a husband providing for a wife, caring for a wife in the event of her illness, being paid to her in the event of kidnapping, and is sharing his money with her, she sharing her money with him, and so on and so forth. This is viewed as sort of a romantic association in terms of the Umes HaElam. In the way that the Torah is Mechayavit, what becomes reality in terms of interrelationships is always in terms of the Mishpat. It's Lasot Chesed Umishpat, not Lasot Chesed. That's a big problem, as Christian love has proven. The worst thing in the world is to be a victim of Christian love. So therefore, the Avram Avinu commitment, Lasot Tzedakah U'Mishpat, and the idea of the interrelationship of Chesed and Mishpat, means that the way to describe the true underlying connectedness of things will always be in terms of how judicially will it end up. And therefore, the entire relationship is defined by Chazal very elaborately, even though we don't actually write this in our ksuvas, but we know that we have all these tanai ksuva in the ksuva itself, which is a virtual ksuva, so to speak, held in bezdin. Whether the person writes the ksuva, he doesn't write the ksuva, and our minig is to write these main points of the ksuva, but not to write up all the tanaim of bezdin. And therefore, these underlying chiyuvim, which provide the underlying levels of the relationship, so to speak, the infrastructure of the relationship, are all exposed to us in the ksuva itself. So that obviously, even though these interrelationships are not actually a chiyuv, in that you can opt out, but there's obviously, once you have to opt out, you're making it clear that the relationship is a different relationship, which we understand. Let's say a woman says, I don't want you to support me, and I'm not sharing my salary with you. I understand that has judicial implications, but quite clearly, it redefines the level of their relationship, as anyone intelligent immediately senses. And you can see the delicacy and the subtlety of the emerging relationships. You can easily sense those differences in terms of what issues of the ksuva obtain and what issues of the ksuva don't obtain. This is not theory. You can clearly see this instantly. The moment that you consider, okay, what would be with marrying a woman who doesn't want support but wants to keep their bank account separate and so on and so forth, right? And this would be true of every level of the interrelationship between Ish v'Isha. The linkage to the underlying infrastructure, which must have an impact on the mishpat of the chesed and tzedakah that is basically part of the marriage, is very fundamental. So what has been left out so far from our discussions about the ksuva is the strange transitional moments, which are Yud Beis Chodesh at a maximum, as we spoke about, the transitional phase of Erisin, in which it is not clear what exactly the Erisin has to do with the Nisuin. Is it simply a commitment to Nisuin? So then how does it create a relationship of Eishes Ish without any type of sexual implications other than being Mechayev, someone who would violate it? And this, of course, is the whole story of the Arusa and the Nara and everything else that we read about in Ketikitetze. On the other hand, we know that Erisin also has other impacts because, for instance, when it comes to Hafaras Nedarim, So then there is no right of the Oros to be made for a neder, but on the other hand, the Oros is necessary for hafaras of a neder together with the Av because of the fact that there is now a transitional phase. But what's the definition of that transitional phase in terms of the underlying infrastructure, which, as we've pointed out, has to be a monetary infrastructure in order for it to become what is called in English the bottom line? And that's why it's called the bottom line, because emotions, and particularly attractions and romance, are very, very fickle, and they are given to narratives. And therefore, unless we have an underlying linkage that would define the Erisin as well, we don't really understand what it is that the Erisin contributes in terms of the relationship that is meant to evolve during the Erisin. And this has been a very open sore throughout the Masechet, because we've never really clarified all of the cases that we spoke about, in which we had an Arusa and we were collecting the Ksuva as an Arusa. And does that mean that there is of necessity a Ksuva for an Arusa? That itself was a Machlokas. Is there a difference between a Ktiva of the Ktuva, which case only then do we have Shi'ibudim on the monetary issues? Or if we just have the virtual ketuvah, which he agreed would apply, is that chal immediately before the chuppah? Is it chal under the chuppah? All of these things were very unclear. And therefore, in order to establish at last, as we get to the end of the Masechet, where we have discussed up until now the inyanim of the interrelationships that are very, very subtle, questions of eva, questions of a sense of mutuality, questions of responsibilities, all of which have been determined by the various Tnaim and Ketuvah, and the question in a particular marriage of what a woman wants to opt out from and nonetheless have a marriage, which note that we started discussing before in cases where she would have a right to insist that I can't live with the guy. And she says, no, I want to live with him anyway. That was the last piece that we had in the previous Perek about the questions of Mumin, where she could say that kind of thing and where she cannot. So in this case, we're finally going to get to very strange that have been, I must tell you, even halacha lemaisa are still very, very unclear to people. And the Gemara is going to open up our eyes to new issues that I think today most people are unaware. When I say most people, I mean even most poskim, are really unaware of what in the world is going on here. So let's take a look at four different situations that we have in our mission. So the four different situations are as follows. A woman owns property, and then she gets erisin. A woman gets erisin, and then she acquires property, let's say, by becoming a yoreshet of property.
Yeah.
See, Gavi doesn't deal with the explosive nature of the boost. I have to be very careful because I steal it. Okay, there we go. This is something my trainer calls these Molotov cocktails. Okay. So, state number one. Woman had property before she gets an erisin. State number two, woman is mureset, gets property. Case number three, the woman has property during erisin, but goes ahead and finally gets to the chuppah. Case number four, the woman inherits property after going to the chuppah. These are the four cases that the Mishnah discusses and gives us, supposedly, the logic behind the situation in all of these cases. And what the problem is going to be determined, once again, by the bottom line. If the woman sells the property that she inherited at any of these stages, we need to determine, A, was it right for her to sell? And that's the lechatchila. And B, if she does sell, is that sale going to be chal? Is it kayemet bidi avad? So these are the cases that we need to examine. Now, remember that her sale of the property is basically, this is very important to recall, when we're talking about selling the property, we are not talking about the sale of the property per se, that is to say, the goof of the property. We're talking about the sale of the property that would allow the buyer to prevent the husband to be zocha to the peros of the chsemelug, right? So in other words, if she is already married and a husband has a right to the property that she brought in, unless, of course, she opted out. But the husband has a right to the property of the Nichse Malug. Remember the difference between Tzon Barzel and Nichse Malug. Tzon Barzel means that that property is hers come hell or high water. It has to be estimated that the husband takes absolute responsibility for the reparations if anything happens to it. That's why it's called Tzon Barzel. It's basically made out of steel because we actually put into the ksuva bride invested X amount of dollars and cents in this property, which I guarantee with the plus of whatever it is that I'm mostly from that guarantee, which we discussed. Is it 1.5? It depends. Metaltim, so on. But okay, that we discussed all of those issues. That's Tzon Barzel. Nichse Malug is what, as the word implies. Malug means you pluck at it. In other words, the Baal gets the right only to the peros. He has absolutely no rights in the determination of the goof of that property. So if she would sell the goof of that property, it certainly is not going to affect his rights to have the Nichse Malug, right? Because, I mean, that's his. But the question is, what if she sells this property before he was actually zocha in the Nichse Malug? That's what we're talking about. So she inherited this property before the Erisin. She sells it before the Erisin. I mean, there obviously he has nothing. He didn't even exist, so to speak, in her life before the Erisin. Now he comes in and said, hey, wait a minute. I heard you were a rich millionaires. Well, I sold everything yesterday, buddy. You should have asked this morning. Too late now. You ain't getting this ring back. Anyway, so that we understand. How could there be any limitations on her rights if he didn't even exist? But suppose she wants to sell the day after she accepts the ring, so to speak, from him. And now she is mu'ures. Well, you'd say to yourself, okay, at what point does the Baal have the right to Nichse Malug? Only after he actually takes her to the chuppah. He doesn't have any rights in her nechasim whatsoever. So how could we look to the dinim of the ketuvah and the bottom line to define for us the nature of the erisin? There is no bottom line. Now, the question is, that's what you think, but the idea of an erisin being a commitment, so to speak, to a growing emergent relationship, which we call chuppah, it turns out, surprisingly, that we discover in this Mishnah is also linked to a bottom line, but it's a bottom line in terms of promise, expectations. It does not create an absolute of a bottom line. So in other words, property that she has while she's in Arusa and what it is that he thinks that their relationship is going to consist of. Now, look, obviously, this the Mefarshim speak out. Now, let's say that this woman has got herself a flock of sheep or something, you know. You want to talk about Malug, plucking. So she actually has a flock of sheep. Nobody is going to consider the question of whether she has a right to eat lamb chops. She can shecht as many of those sheep as she wants, and that's not an expected part of the marriage. But when you're talking about property, where it's understood that at the beginning, when you're planning a wedding, that this wedding is planning a future life together. And that future life, we've already discussed elements of it in terms of a parent's commitment, haven't we? What is the din if a parent commits and then the wedding doesn't go through? So though we had all of those fascinating cases before, whether the av is mechuyev to continue to give, as it was at Aldas specifically, that there should be a wedding, what happens if she dies before, what happens if he dies before, and so on and so forth. At great length, we discussed that issue. We have never discussed what the relationship is between the two of them, where there was a presumption of there being a situation of Nichse Malug. So now the question is, does that indeed provide any type of at least moral rights, which would only be lechatchila? You shouldn't have sold that because both of you were expecting at one point or another to make that part of your wedding, so to speak, of your coming together as a marriage, and you never opted out, and therefore you shouldn't have sold it. But still, it wouldn't determine an underlying fact. So these are the kind of issues that we're going to discuss, including the question of at what point is that moral right or financial right, at what point does it end? Does it end at the nisuin, at which point if she doesn't opt out, that any properties that are currently present, even though they were hers from before and he didn't even exist, are still considered to be part of the promise and therefore the reality of the nisuin? And then if she would go ahead and sell at that point, then for sure he would be able to prevent the sale that affects the nechse malug in terms of his peros, in terms of the malug, so to speak. Now, as far as what about the goof of the karka? So as far as the goof of the karka, which is not what we're discussing here, which is going to take us some time for the Gemara to establish, remember that there is a takonas usha. And the takonas usha is that a woman who sells nechse malug, that the husband can even take the goof of the karka away from the lekuchas. But that's only if she dies and he inherits her. Which means that if someone, after takonas usha, makes a deal with a woman to buy the goof of the karka, fully understanding that he cannot get rights to the peirot because she doesn't own those rights while the relationship with her husband is extant, what he's actually doing is taking a gamble. What he's actually doing is he's saying, look, I'm willing to give you 30 cents on the dollar for your property with the understanding that if you die before your husband, then he's going to inherit this field and I don't have anything in the field. There's a big machlokas rishonim, whether does that mean he just loses his money because it's a gamble, or does it mean that the money that he paid is repaid to him, so that the husband would still own him that money? Okay, this is a big discussion, which is outside of the range of today's Gemara. But certainly, the takanas usha is he takes the field. And that would be even where she sold the gufa karka. That is indeed a takana. Okay, as far as our mission is concerned, which is pre-takanas usha, the takanas usha took place later, what we're talking about over here is the rights to the nechse malug and the peiros of the nechse malug if she sold them out from under him before he was actually zocha in them. So those are our four cases. And you can see why they're different. If she was first zocha in the karka before he appeared, and now she wants to sell after he does appear, she gives her heiress. She was zocha in the property after he appeared with the erison and wants to sell during the erison. She was zocha in the property at some point earlier, either, according to Rashi, either prior to the erison or prior to the nisuin. This is a discussion of Rishonim. We'll take Rashi's approach to the Mishnah that there's no difference whether she was zocha to this property all the way at the beginning before even the erison. And now she is a nisua. Can she sell those prior owned properties? And the fourth case, she actually inherited this property after she was a nisua, had not opted out from the ksuva, and now she wants to sell that property. What would be the din? So let's take a look at our Mishnah, which has a number of different approaches and approaches to the approaches, which makes it a little bit complicated because we often find this. We have a machlokas, let's say, Beit Shammai Beit Hillel, as we have over here. And then we have a machlokas about whether Beit Shammai Beit Hillel really had that machlokas or whether it was a different machlokas. Fine. This will become clear as we go along. First, let's keep things simple. So, Hayishar Shenaflula Nechasim Ad Shelo Titaretz. Case number one. These Nechasim she inherited before this guy ever appeared in her life. He wasn't her husband, not for Erison, and certainly not for Nisuin. Everybody agrees in that case. Now note, it's very important for us to utilize the Lashon of the Mishnah correctly. Mocheret venotenet is very different than im bachra kayam. Mocheret venotenet means that she has every right, moral and legal, to sell. Because since she inherited this property before he was even there, There's absolutely no limitations. Even lechatchila, she goes ahead and she sells. Okay. How about second case? How about if naflu la mishenit arsa? How about if after he appeared and after he gave her the ring, then she inherits these properties? So then we have a machlokas, our first machlokas. Beit Shammai says she can sell even lechatchila, mocheret, and there's no problem. Whereas Beit Hillel says, well, morally, she's not supposed to sell. Lo timkar, but we're both going to agree, both Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are modim, that if she did sell, even though perhaps she shouldn't have, that lamaisa the necher is kayam, or the gift is kayam, machrav and atna, bidi avad, it's kayam. So now Rabbi Yehuda says, let's take a little break to discuss the logic of this for a moment before we introduce the next cases. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, you know the Chachamim taina to Rabbi Gamliel, why is there, this doesn't make sense. Because look, later on, so it's based on an assumption that we already know what's going to say later on. Later on, the din is that he, after Nisuin, she cannot sell, right? So if what we're saying is that here Erison gives her gives him a schus to her because she's an arusa, she's considered to be an eishes ish. What is that schus if it doesn't give him any rights? I mean, if it was kena her, should he not be kena also her nechasim? Doesn't he have some level of balut on her property? Now, that doesn't make sense, does it? Why should she have balut on her property? Since until this point, we don't have the din of his rights to Nechasim. He doesn't have rights to Nechse Malug during Erison. Nobody says that he has such rights during Erison, correct? So this is a weird kind of question, which the Gemara is going to discuss. And it turns out that the language here is going to provide us a key in understanding what basically is misunderstood about this Mishnah. So the question over here was, if he's zocha in the wife, should he not be zocha in the nechasim? To which Rabbi Gamliel said, look, the idea that you're bringing me, which comes from the fact that after she would actually be a nesuah, which is case number 4, which we haven't gotten to yet, and which the Mishnah is pre-configuring over here in understanding the taina against Rabbi Gamliel, namely, in the event that a husband gets a woman and he takes her to the chuppah, doesn't he have rishus over her nechse malug and she wouldn't be able to sell it in a way that would prevent him from eating the peres? Yeah. So therefore, in this case, if he got the woman, wouldn't it be the same? To which Rabbi Gamliel says, even that halakha embarrasses me. It's absurd. Why in the world should she not be able to sell her own property after she becomes a nesua? Why do you say that a husband has the right to take that property back from the buyers? How could he have that right to take the property back from the buyers? I understand that it's your right to demand a pay raise, but what do you mean when you say he could take the property back from the buyers if they paid good money for that property? Now, listen. That sounds very much like Takanas Usha. And later on, the Gemara say, wait a minute. The Mishnah was written before Takanas Usha. Why are you saying that he has a right to take the property miyad alukuchot? We'll discuss that. And the Gemara is going to clarify the difference between the din and the Mishnah about the husband's right to the property and Takanas Usha's rights that are given to the property. So we'll talk about that later. But in any event, Rabbi Gamliel says, I am simply embarrassed about the fact that the Rabbanan said that the husband is able to be motzi miyad alekuchot. This is even where we're talking about property that came after the nisuin. So you want to throw on me, atem megalgalim aleinu et hayishanim? You want to stop her from selling properties that she got while she was an arusa or before? What are you talking about? It doesn't make any sense. Why should we? Okay. So then you're making things very tough by asking this weird question. All right, let's set aside the question of logic, which the Gemara will discuss, and move on to cases 3 and 4, okay? So now, the third case. The third case is that in the event that she was already a Nisua, and then she inherits property, nobody argues. Now, you'll notice that this is not actually in order, right? It should go property before Erisin, property after Erisin, property before Eris, before Nisuin, and then Nisuin, and then property after Nisuin. But we don't want to do that because we want to go in the order of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are both modeh that there's, she can even lechatchila sell in case one. Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are both modeh in case 3, which is after Nisuin. That's why we make that case 3. And then, but they argue in case 4, which is the equivalent of case 2, where they argued up front, right? So we have cases 1 and 2. Let's call that 1A, 1B. And then we have case 2, which is case 2A and case 2B. That way we understand why we have this Seder. All right. So then the third case, which is 2A, where she inherited only after the Nisuin, then she can't sell. That's for sure, because the husband already had the rights. But, I mean, that still does not make it reasonable to say that the husband can go ahead and take them away from the buyer. That we don't understand. Okay, but nonetheless, apparently everybody agrees to that, both Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Okay, case 4. If she inherited the property before the Nisuin, at any point before the Nisuin, either while she was an Arusa, according to Rashi, even if she inherited the property prior to her being an Arusa. And then she went ahead and we're now up to the point of Nisuin. So the halakha over there is that Rabbi Gamliel maintains that in that case, even though she shouldn't, remember the way the language is, she shouldn't sell, but if she did sell, Imachra, or she gave it away as a gift, matna, it would be kayam. Now, Rabbi Hanina ben Akavya, that's going to turn out that Rabbi Hanina ben Akavya is just going to apply Rabbi Yehuda's logic. Remember, it's so important because it's very confusing, the back and forth. Remember, we have cases 1 and 2, and then Rabbi Yehuda explaining why it doesn't make any sense, right? And Rabbi Gamliel saying, oh, I'm embarrassed. Now we have cases 2, 3, and 4. We still have Rabbi Yehuda saying it doesn't make any sense because Rabbi Gamliel says he wasn't able to take it from Lukuchas, right? And we also have, in this case, instead of quoting Rabbi Yehuda, and we'll see why this is important because otherwise we're going to have contradictions later on in the Gemara, that in this case, Rabbi Hanina ben Akavya said what Rabbi Yehuda said. Doesn't make any sense. Rabbi Gamliel, what are you talking about? Rabbi Gamliel, if he already was zocher in his wife in the chuppah, should he not be zocher in the nechasim? She should also, it should be the same thing. So we're talking about over here that even though we had property that she was yoreshet as an arusa, and nonetheless, if she sells it as an Asua, she shouldn't be allowed to. And you say that she is allowed to? Lo yizkeh ben nechasim that she owned from before? Omar lahem, Rabbi Gamliel said the same thing. Even if she got the property now, which is new property after the Nisuin, ala chadashim anu borshim, how does that give the Baal a right just because he has a schus? Remember, any property that wasn't evaluated, remember what that's called. The chasim that are shumim, they are estimated in value in the chuppah, in the ktsuvah, which is the nichsei tzon barzel. Anything other than that is called nichsei maluk. So remember we talked about what if she wins the lottery? What if she finds $1 million on the beach? All of those dinim are nichsei maluk. We'll use the money to buy her property as an investment, but he'll still get the income as long as the marriage remains, until it's dissolved either by divorce or in death. If it's dissolved by divorce, so then, of course, it's totally hers. If it's dissolved by death, it depends by whose death. If she dies, then part of the agreement was that he inherits her. If he dies before her, then the halakha is that her heirs, that's the, remember, one of the dinim of the ksuvah, that her heirs will inherit her. And not only that, they won't have to split it with the other heirs, right? That were the tznoyim of the benindich, tuchrin, and so on. Okay. So here Rabbi Gamaliel says the same thing. I don't understand why a husband should be able to take things away from somebody who bought them. Okay. So now we've got these situations, and we've introduced a new halacha of Rabbi Gamaliel. Rabbi Gamaliel saying that bidyavad, if she inherited it before the nisuin, this sale is good. Now, it's not clear whether we're talking about like Rabbi Shammai, Beis Hillel, is he arguing? All of that we're going to be taking a look at in the Gemara. Now we introduce a new halacha. Rabbi Shimon cholek bein nechasim lenechasim. Rabbi Shimon says, actually, it depends. Because remember that the whole idea over here is giving a status during erusin of the coming to the nisuin that the erusin was meant to arrange for. Suppose the husband doesn't even know that these properties exist, and she doesn't say anything about these properties existing. So, in that case, can we really say that the issues of the erusin were meant to supply this as part of the wedding? She obviously didn't think so, because she would have told him, oh, darling, wait till I cash in on my estate in Italy, right? But he never heard of the estate in Italy. So therefore, Tainus Rebbe Shimon, that if these halachas are based on a status of erusin that relates to nisuin, so then if he doesn't know anything about it, there should be no moral limitations on her mechira either. So in that case, I say, nechasim hayeduim lebaal lo timkor. If he knows about it, so then ein hachinami, the halacha would be that she loses those rights, and if she did sell them, the mechira would be bata. But if he never knew about it, so then she shouldn't sell if the nisuin already went through, but if she did, it should be good. We'll see exactly in the Gemara what the relationship is to prior to nisuin or prior to erusin that the Gemara is going to discuss. Now, there were very interesting halakha lemaisa issues that were raised that Rav Moshe Paskind about, particularly a fascinating case where a husband was aware of the fact that his wife owned certain stocks, bonds, and so on, but he had no idea that he had any access to those properties just because of the fact that he married her. And so he had made arrangements, legal arrangements, that didn't include those things because he didn't know that they were his. Then he found out that he has a right lahalacha to those things, and she never opted out. So he knew about them. Rav Moshe Paskins, that in that event, since he did not know that they would be part of the marriage, the Gemara over here, which we Paskin like, I'll leave it to Rebbe Shimon, of the difference between properties that were meant to be built into the marriage or properties that were not, makes them dependent on whether he knew about them or whether they were in Italy and he had no idea. Says Rav Moshe Paskin, like those shittas who say that and it's actually the truth is it's mostly his chiddush, and he brings many rayas, that not knowing that you have rights is exactly the same as not knowing of the existence of the property. Because basically the underlying logic of Rebbe Shimon is the fact that the marriage took into consideration, the original erusin took into consideration the fact that we would be building a life together on the basis of this property, and he never knew that, in which case he did not plan on that, and it wasn't part of the rights. Tremendous, tremendous. It's amazing to see the translation of these issues into contemporary daily life and like what is actually involved in terms of the emotional or moral interrelationships. But okay, I'm just bringing that in to make it more relevant and clear as to how many subtle details could be involved in the practicalities of a marriage. Now, ask the Gemara, okay, let's understand the difference between the first case and the second case, because I don't really get it. Maishna Reisha Delo Pligi, how come Beit Shammai Beit Hillel agree in the very first case where the property was hers before this guy ever appeared on the scene? And then the second case, where she inherits the property while the guy has already given her a ring, what meaning is there to give her a ring? Now, this is the way that the Gemara is forcing us to zero in on the strange new relationship that we're claiming has financial underpinnings during the state of Eris. So in classic Gemara form, it first takes the broadest possible question, what the heck is the difference? And everybody says to himself, what do you mean, what the heck is the difference? I mean, if he wasn't there, then she was Zocha. And if he is there, then there are things that he owns, aren't there? So, okay. So that's what basically the Gemara is going to say. Well, what do you mean? Ami Devei Rabbi Yanai, in the first case in the Mishnah, the Nechasim fell to her while she was entirely her own boss, Bizchuta. So she has all the rights. However, in the Seifa, since he was already there and had been Ma'aris her, they are falling into a situation where he does have rights. He does? I mean, how does he have rights? If you're saying that he does have rights, then why is she able to sell Bidiavad even? How did this become a moral issue, whether she should sell or she shouldn't sell? It should be a question of even if she did sell. And you said, as Beit Ali Machra V'Natna, it's Kayam. That's what you said. Well, I don't get it. If you're telling me that he has rights, Im Bizchuto Naflu, so then why, again, we're forcing us to zero in on what we mean by his chus, if in fact he was Zocha, so then how come even Bidiavad, that it stands and he cannot take it away from the people who bought? Ella, the difference is that the Reisha, what we really meant to say is that in the Reisha, the case was that there was no presence of him at all. So therefore, it was Vadai Bizchuta Naflu. It's 100% her own. In the Seifa, there might be a way of looking at it as Eimar Bizchuta Ve'Eimar Bizchuto. What in the world does that mean? It means that there is something similar to a suffix in terms of the ownership of Erisin, which is weird. Erisin isn't a suffix, is it? Erisin is a status of a kinyan, which the Torah gives him right to be made for Nedarim together with the Av, and in which if somebody violates the sanctity of their relationship, so he's high of Misa, and so on and so forth. What exactly do you mean, Eimar? So it's clear that what we're talking about over here is an aspect of Erisin, which is taken into consideration as being part of an emergent process towards Nisuin. As in all emergent processes, the beginning of the process takes into consideration the end of the process. However, we cannot guarantee the end of the process. It's dependent on all types of, so to speak, random events, such as, do we both survive to the chuppah? Such as, will I still like you? Will you still like me? Yay, sirrah, sirrah. So if you recognize that if you're dealing with a right that is a provision of a process, you never know, do you? So what that means is, and we're going to see that we can back this up with an argument in the Gemara, as we're about to see, which is extremely confusing Gemara. What this means is that there is a particular right that is granted to the Baal as a given, in which Erisin is a somewhat element of Nisuin. And that is the reason that everybody's asking, well, how come if she's already Nisua, he gets a right, But if she's an Arusi, he doesn't get a right. I mean, what a stupid question. If she's an Nesua, then the Baal has the right to the next Malug. If she's an Arusi, the Baal doesn't have a right to the next Malug. So what kind of stupid question is it to say, how come if she sells it and she's an Nesua, he could take it away, but if it's an Arusi, not? I mean, what are you, 2-year-old? So in other words, we're taking for granted that the Chachomim's underpinnings of the nature of Iksuva, which applies to some extent, as we've seen, even in Erisin, would also mean that the incipient Nisuin provides him a moral right, at least, to the things that are meant to be brought into the marriage. And therefore, we're asking if that right enables him to take it away from the Lekuchas, which doesn't follow, as Rabbi Gamliel said, why take it away from the Lekuchas? Just insist on getting the rental to the property, or just insist on getting the value of the crops or whatever. But why do you take it away? You don't have any rights to it. I'm embarrassed by that din, which, as we said, seems to resemble Takanas Usha. And the Gemara is going to ask, isn't that the same thing as Takanas Usha? And we'll explain to us today why it's not. But in any event, since we cannot talk about a process as if it's already ended, therefore, on the one hand, you could look at it as saying that it was bischuta, emar bischuta. On the other hand, emar bischuto. So therefore, we say, look, she shouldn't sell it because there is definitely the chances of this property being taken into consideration as part of the future. But we can't prove that to prevent you from selling it in terms of the legality. We can only tell you, well, how do you know you have a right to sell that? But if you do sell it, we can't take it away either. Because basically at that point, the rights are not 100% rights. They are emergent rights, which is a completely new concept we've never heard of before. It's introduced here by this Mishnah, the idea not of suffix rights, but emergent rights, which basically are, in terms of the judicial ability, would be the equivalent of being a suffix. Now, nobody holds Erisin as a suffix, but the rights end up being treated, since we can never know, treated as if we look at it as a suffix. So, l'chatchila lo timkar, im machra v'natna kayam. So now I want to understand, what was Rabbi Yehuda's objection? Okay, Rabbi Yehuda, and this is the point to ask that question, isn't it? Because Rabbi Yehuda is saying it, isn't it the same? If he was Zocha to the Isha, well, obviously it's not the same. So what exactly was Rabbi Yehuda saying? We'd like to understand, first of all, did he mean to say that even B'diavad, it shouldn't be kosher? Or did he mean to say, I don't understand how Beit Shammai says that morally she can even go ahead and sell it l'chatchila? What was he talking about when he said this to Rabbi Gamliel? So Amar lifnei Rabbi Gamliel. What? Ibailu, was Rabbi Yehuda objecting to the fact that Beit Shammai says that l'chatchila you're able to go and sell property that you were only were yoresh after erisin? You shouldn't be doing it l'chatchila. And therefore, that would mean that there was never a taina on why is it kosher afterwards if she went ahead and did it, or was the question mamish on the b'diavad? So that would mean that he is asking, why do you say that it's kosher if she sold it after erisin? It should be the same thing as selling after nisuin. So that's the first question. Now, obviously, gentlemen, what we ought to say at this point is, well, since it makes no sense to say that it should be batal, so then why isn't that a dumb question? Why doesn't Rebbe Gamliel should simply answer, what are you talking about? If it was after Nisuin, he is Zaycha the Nechsei Maluk, so she can't sell it. But if it was before the Nisuin, he didn't have Zechus in the Nechsei Maluk. So if she sold it, how can he prevent the sale from going through, right? That should disturb us. And we're going to see that there's a whole different version of the Mishnah in which that's exactly what happened. And that Rabbi Gamliel pointed out that what you're saying makes no sense, sort of. But he doesn't do it right. And that's going to give us the key to what it is that we were just understanding about the nature of an emergent right, and why I call it an emergent right and not a Suffolk right. So, Toshma, I'll prove to you what he was talking about. He was talking 100% about even Bidiavad. I don't understand why Bidiavad, it's kosher. Why did Beit Hillel say it's kosher? Take a look at this brisa and you'll see what Reb Yehuda was saying. Toshma, the Tanya, Reb Yehuda, Rulif, Dei Reb Gamliel. Look, both cases, Nisuin, Erisin, in both cases, she's a wife, right? So if the Nisuaz Mikra is batel, so then the Arusa's Mikra should be batel. Okay, now it's absolutely clear what he's asking, right? He's asking, why isn't it batel? That means he's asking even Alibet Beit Hillel, why should it be kosher b'diavad? It shouldn't be kosher at all. An Arusa should be the same as a Nisua. A nonsensical question on the surface. So, well, Marlahem, to which Rabbi Gamliel said, I believe that even the din of the Baal being motzi miyad ala kuchos from the Nesua is an embarrassment. It's crazy. Ala chadashim anu boshim. What, you want to say that even the property that she owned before during the erison, that should also be boto? Okay, but anyway, whatever the conversation was, is it clear that Shmamina Diavad Kamar? He was saying it ought to be bottle, even the Diavad. That is the answer, Shmamina. Now, Tanya, let's look at the next piece of that brisa, and now we suddenly get a different version of what Rabbi Gamliel said in response to the Chachomi. Tanya, Omer Rabbi Chanina ben Akavya. And note that in the Mishnah, Reb Chanina ben Akavya is brought only at the end to take the place of the question about the logic after the introduction of cases three and four, right? Cases one and two. I'm sorry for doing this again and again, but I know how confusing this is if you don't get the structure right. The structure of the Mishnah was cases one and two prior to Erisin and subsequent to Erisin, followed by the logic question of Rabbi Yehuda's description of what the Chachomim taina. And the second part of the Mishnah was questions in the wrong order of three and four, which was post-Nisuin and prior to Nisuin, followed by Rabbi Chanina ben Akavya's question as to the logic. Okay, that was the Mishnah. Now here we see that Rabbi Chanina ben Akavya has a different version of the first question that was asked after parts one and two of the Mishnah, where Rabbi Yehuda is quoted in the Mishnah as having a conversation to which Rabbi Gamliel replied, I'm embarrassed. It doesn't make any sense to me. Whereas Rabbi Chanina ben Akavya said, he should have answered a much more slap across the face answer. He should have said to them, what a dumb question. How can you compare the status after Nisuin to the status before Nisuin, right? And that is, according to Rabbi Chanina ben Akavya, exactly what happened. That's not what Rabbi Gamliel said. Why would he say we're embarrassed? He could have explained the difference very clearly. Kachishivan, what are you, crazy? Loim amartam b'nisua. If you're talking about a nisua, that's because her husband is zeiche at that point to her mitziyah, to her maaseyadeah, to her afaras nidareah. So obviously she can't sell it out from under him. Masha einkein over here, an arusa? What's the matter with you? Ein ba'ala zakai, lo b'mitziyata, lo b'maaseyadeah, lo b'afaras nidareah. Why the heck should she not be allowed to do whatever the heck she wants to do? Now, the answer that Rabbi Chanina ben Akavya said that Rabbi Gamliel gave is a crazy answer. What should the answer have been? The answer should have been, are you out of your mind? In the case of a Nesua, he is Zocheter Nichse Malug. In the case of an Arusa, he's not Zocheter Nichse Malug. And therefore, why would he be able to be Motzi Miyad L'Kuchas if she sold the Nichse Malug, which is, of course, anything that she inherited? Why did he leave out the whole point and instead start talking about crazy issues which are not relevant? What do I care about Afaras Nedarim? Talk to me about what we're talking about. We're talking about Nichse Malug. You're claiming that we should treat the Nichse Malug of an Arusa the same way we treat the Nichse Malug of an Nesua who cannot sell. I think a 2-year-old wouldn't ask a dumb question like that. if the Arusa doesn't have, he doesn't have any rights on Arusa Nichseim alone, well, of course he can't prevent the sale, right? The main issue is not addressed. Am I making sense, guys? I'm getting a bunch of blank looks over here. Trying to give you an insight into this incredible Mishnah. Hello, Reb Barnea. Okay, how many thumbs up do we have in understanding what the problem is? Three?
Robert, keep your hands on the wheel.
You're always holding your phone. Why can't you give me a thumbs up? Semis. I hate the semi-trailers. Reels. Okay. Fine. All right. That's because you've been drinking, Richie, before the daf. Okay. So why am I making such a big fuss over this? Because that's the whole point. And if you don't see that that's the whole point, then you lose the meaning of the Mishnah, which is what happens to most people when they learn this Mishnah. And they have a kasha on this, and they leave the kasha hanging. Why not mention Nichseim alone? That's not a kasha. That's the whole point. Therefore, what we must be saying, obviously, is that the meaning of the rights of an arusa, of an orus, which shouldn't exist at all in the context of this Mishnah, which make it maybe even a bidyavad, but certainly a lechatchila, that she shouldn't sell out Nichsei Maluk, to which she has zero rights. She shouldn't sell Nichsei Maluk out from under him. What out from under him? He doesn't have any rights to it. That is obviously not true. So where did he get these rights? Therefore, the point over here is that Erison is Nisuin, but it's the emergent process of the Nisuin. And therefore, they are incipient rights. If they're incipient rights, then there should be concern for his ability to at least lechatchila prevent her from selling. And Rabbi Yehuda is saying, maybe even bidyavad. I mean, it's going to affect the emergent wedding, isn't it? So it'd be like saying, so what if I remove a couple of genes from a fetus while it's in the first month of development, at which point those genes have not yet been utilized and translated into anything? It's not going to hurt the fetus, is it? That's all very nice. It's not going to hurt the fetus now, but when he ends up being born without arms, it will. So therefore, whenever you've got an incipient issue that's going to affect the relationship, it's a given that Chazal would have provided rights to what will affect the emergent relationship. That's why I'm calling it emergent. It's not an actual right, but it's taken for granted in the interrelationship of Erisin and Nisuin. That's the point of the Gemara. So obviously, Rabbi Gamaliel is not going to say, what a dumb question. He doesn't have rights to Nichsei Maluk. But that's the whole issue, is that he will have rights to Nichsei Maluk, and that's why the Erisin is taken for granted as providing him the possibility, perhaps, of preventing what's going to destroy their marriage afterwards. Richie, are you trying to ask something?
Yes, I am. Rabbi, would you compare the Erisin? Would you say that the Erisin was, at this point, in Schrodinger's box?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the...
Yes, insofar as any process is basically sitting up there with the possibilities entangled. That's true. So when we know, we know. But up until then, the question is, what do we do if she did sell? And what should we be careful about if it wasn't yet done? Exactly. Okay. So therefore, he only mentions issues that are peripheral. So, Rulo, now, this was, remember, the response to cases 1 and 2. So now the Chachomim, and this is the version of Rabbi Chanina ben Akavya, now the Chachomim say to him, Rabbi, that makes a lot of sense when she sold the property before she even became a Nesua. But what do you say about where she first became a Nesua and then she sold the property? What about then? Says Rabbi Gamliel, I think that even there, she would, if she did, I don't think she should, but if she did, it should be Kayam, because since she had these properties before she was a Nesua, so then she is not Mechuyev to hand them over. That's what I hold. So then they said the second part, which is after cases 3 and 4, the Taina Amru Lo, Oyel V'Zacha B'Isha Lo Yizkub Nechasim. So, I mean, over here, he mamish owns the woman in the sense that she is now a Nesua, and he does have a right to Nechsei Malug, and he does have a right to all of these other things, the Mitziyatana, Faris Doreh, and so on. So why shouldn't he be able to prevent her from selling Lo Yizkub Nechasim? And here, Amar Lahem, here the only answer he had, because he couldn't answer the difference, he simply said, well, I don't think it's reasonable even to have made this takana ala chadashim. You want to throw in even properties that she owned before she was in a Nesua? Wait, before we get to discuss this, says the Gemara, you just said in this braita something that contradicts the Mishnah. In the Mishnah, it says that if she inherited this property, at shaloni seit v'niseit, Rebbe Gamliel said that if she sells, then imach rabbanatna kayemet. But in the version that Rebbe Gamliel answered in the Braita, he said avzu mocheret v'notenet, which is lechatchila. I don't understand. Did Rebbe Gamliel hold lechatchila, or did Rebbe Gamliel hold like it says in the Mishnah that b'diavad? I mean, you can't have a contradiction between Rabbi Gamliel and the Mishnah and Rabbi Gamliel and the Baraita, can you? Omer of Zvid, yeah. This is wrong. You have to read in the Mishnah, Mocheret v'notenet, even the Chatchila, not Imachra v'notna. Mocheret v'notenet, and it's good. Rav Papa says, hold on a second, gentlemen, wait a minute over here. There were two different versions. There was Rav Yehuda's version, which the Mishnah recorded after cases 1 and 2. And then there's this version that we're quoting from Rabbi Hanina, which is after versions 2 and 3. So, I mean, basically what's happened is that the Mishnah is trying to give us over Rabbi Yehuda's approach while hinting that there's another approach according to Rabbi Hanina ben Akavya. And therefore, I say, it's true. The Mishnah that says if she sold, it should be kosher, that's Rabbi Yehuda's approach. And this Braita is going according to Rav Hanina ben Akavya, where Rabbi Gamliel says, I don't think that there should even be a moral issue, and she should be able to sell. And even though we quoted Rabbi Hanina ben Akavya in the Mishnah, we didn't mean that that's what he says. We're only presenting him as the first level representative of what Rabbi Yehuda would have said, and giving us the information, guys, peek into the Braisa if you want to see something even more striking, which is that according to him, Rabbi, you should be able to sell even lechatchila. What? But then that means that he's claiming that Rabbi Gamliel is going like Beit Shammai? What? The Rechaninim and Akavik and Beit Shammai? So Rabbi Gamliel is coming out and out and saying, no, even lechatchila. So in other words, what we're saying is, I mean, obviously, if Beit Shammai holds in the first cases, the case number 2, that it's only a b'diavad, so obviously, in this case, it would only be a b'diavad, and Rabbi Gamliel is claiming it's a lechatchila. No, of course he doesn't make it. He believes that there was no such machlokes. What Rabbi Hananya ben Akavya is saying is, lo nechlaku Beit Shammai u'Beit Hillel al hadavar, there never was such a machlokes. That's very different from Rabbi Yehuda. He holds. And according to him, if the property was hers from before the Nisuin, it's exactly the same as it was in the Resha. Meidim, Beit Shammai, or Beit Hillel, that she can be mocheret, even lechatchil. Woo! Okay. Now, Rav Shmuel de Amrei Tarvayu, in terms of the halacha, both Rav and Shmuel Paskin, whether she inherited this property before the Erisin, whether she inherited this property after the Erisin, And then she went ahead and she becomes a nesua. If she sells any kind of property after nesuin, a baal motzi miyad alekuchot. What? Wait a second over here. That doesn't follow anybody. It doesn't follow Rabbi Yehuda. It doesn't follow Rabbi Chanina ben Akavya. And don't try to tell me, what do you mean it doesn't? Yes, it does. It follows the Chachomim that argue on Rabbi Gamliel. The Chachomim never argued on Rabbi Gamliel. The Chachomim were reported by Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Hananya ben Akavya as asking, why does this make sense? They never say, we disagree with you. So you can't tell me that they're going according to a shita that never was expressed as a binding shita. So who are they going according to? It's nuts. And now the Gemara introduces us to a completely new shita that we didn't know existed. And that is the end of the Braita. Inu diamri ki rabotenu detanya, rabotenu chazru v'nimnu, that after all of this discussion, there was a vote in Beis Din. And in the vote in Beis Din, they were metakein, bein shenafnu la shelot itares. I don't care if she inherited this before this guy ever appeared on the scene, or bein shenafnu la after the erusin, but if she became a nesua, if she sells property that came into her possession at any point after nesuin, habal motzi miyad halakuchot. What? You're saying everybody agrees that Mishnah said elu ve'elu modim? Hey, that's what it said in the Mishnah at the end. Once she sells properties that she inherited after nesuin, even the Mishnah says that the husband can take them away. And as we've pointed out, how is that possible? Isn't that takanas usha, which took place way after the time of the Mishnah? Lema tanina la takanas usha? Does this mean that the takanas usha is embedded in a Mishnah? The Amar Rabbi Yossi bar Rabbi Chanina, b'usha hitkino. The takanas usha was, looks like Gavi's planning a trip to Usha today just to give it to us. B'usha hitkino. Aisha shemachra b'nichsei malug b'chayei ba'ala u'meta abal motzi miyad alekuchot. So if she sells her nichsei malug and she goes ahead and dies before the husband can go and take away the goof of the property from the buyers. Says the Gemara, what are you talking about? You're totally confused. The Mishnah is never discussing the goof of the property, silly. The Mishnah was talking about the pay rights. And the Mishnah was saying that during the time that he zochet to Paris, when is that time? When she's alive. So the Masnisin is talking about Bechaya. During her lifetime, the husband can take away the field to get the pay rights. But if she goes and dies, he has to give that field to the buyer because the buyer owned the goof of the karka. In Usha, they made an incredible takana that the buyer doesn't even own the rights to the actual goof of karka that he bought. And he loses his bet because she never was able to sell that. And therefore, she's got to be paid back by the husband, maybe, or if the woman left any money, that's a machlokas. But this is the takanas usha, is way beyond the Mishnah. And don't misunderstand what the Mishnah was saying. Obviously, in the Mishnah, all he can do is taking them away from the buyer for the pay raise. But if she ends up dying, he has to give the whole thing back. Because then he doesn't have any pay raise, obviously. How does he have pay raise if she's dead? The takanas usha is that schus to the parents gave him rights even to the goof in terms of inheritance. Tremendous. And Rabbi Shimon is cholek by nechasim, whether he knew about it or he didn't know about it. So what is that? What defines known or what defines unknown? Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Chanina says, known properties is real estate, because real estate is traceable. And unknown properties are metaltaling, which we can assume he didn't know about. Rabbi Yochanan says, no. Anything local, anybody can find out. What we're talking about Enanya doing is where she's got an estate in Italy that the guy would have no way of knowing anything about. And that's Koshi or Shevet Khan. She, her whole life has been living here in Bavel. How's he supposed to even think about the fact that she had a great uncle who left her a castle in Italy? It never occurs to him. So Khan, here what we're talking about is specifically Nafilo Nechasim, B'medinat Hayam, and indeed Tanya Namayachi. What defines Enanya doing? Koshi or Shevet Khan V'Nafilo Nechasim, B'medinat Hayam. All right. I'm sorry for taking so long. I really had meant to get up to the next Mishnah. I don't think there was any way to do this in a way that people would not get confused any faster, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just old and slow, but I'm trying my best. So thank you. I hope I didn't bore you, and I hope you get a chance to review this and to actually hop the incredible meaning of this Mishnah and its insights, which are truly mind-boggling, open up our view and our understanding of the nature of Ksuva being bound to underlying infrastructure, which is translatable into Mishpat and makes a massive difference to our understanding the nature of Erisin as well. Wow. Okay. Go to everyone. Have a wonderful day.